Thankful to be with you once again this evening, and realize, as Stan mentioned, we have, I guess, for the most part, home folks here tonight. And I just want to say, sometimes we wait till the final night of a gospel meeting. We have a lot of visitors here, and sometimes I don't remember everything that I want to say. So I want to make sure that this evening I express to you how much I appreciate this congregation. I've attended here maybe only a couple of times before this. I actually can only remember once in attending here, and have been acquainted with brethren here, certainly with names of folks here, and have always appreciated the work being done in this place. But it takes on a very new significance to me now that I can put a face, and more than just a face, to know about your life and about your faith and about your walk with the Lord, and the things that you're doing here, and the unique struggles with various folks and families in this congregation. You mean that much more to me. I've appreciated the wonderful hospitality of families that have had me into their home, that have taken me out, provided anything and everything that I could possibly need while I'm here. And so thankful to the elders. They have provided for everything, provided a wonderful place for me to stay, transportation, that being able to fly down here, which I think ended up probably being cheaper than it would have been to drive anyway. But still, all of these things being taken care of, I want you to know how much it means to me. It enables and empowers me to be able to focus on the preaching of the gospel and not to have to have all of these cares and these worries, and it is a blessing, tremendous blessing. And don't think that it's been taken for granted. The song leading this week has been outstanding. All of the song leaders have just done a tremendous job. And I've always known that there was good song leading in this congregation because of the work that Josh did with us up in Lubbock. And I knew that that Stan and others here had developed some good song leaders in this congregation. But it's been a wonderful experience to have the time to be with you through this week. And the singing has just been tremendous. Last night it was wonderful. The night before was wonderful. Tonight it was great. And that definitely sets the tone for the meeting. And more than just setting the tone, it lifts up our hearts in worship. And it's just been a real boon to my faith to be able to be a part of the song service here in this congregation. So all of these things I want to thank you for. And of course, there's so many other things that I could say. Just the special time of being able to be with the Cox family and others that I am especially close to. This has been a good week. And I just wanted to point those things out tonight while we're all together and it's just us tonight. Tomorrow night, I'm sure I'll have some things to say, but I may not have as much time. And we'll have hopefully a lot of visitors here tomorrow night. It's amazing that after this evening, we have only one more night. It's hard to believe because it honestly seems like yesterday that I was telling you this week is going to fly by. And it's already here, and most of our opportunities are gone. So I want to urge you to redouble your efforts this evening and in the morning to reach out to and to follow up on some of the invitations that you've made, and try to get some of those people to be here tomorrow night. Tonight and tomorrow night, our lessons are going to be primarily words of exhortation. And the last two nights, Monday night and Tuesday night, was primarily on some doctrinal matters, and tonight and tomorrow night's going to be words of exhortation. But they will be helpful for anyone and everyone. Tomorrow night's lesson, especially, a saint or not, it is going to be some very deeply heartfelt words of exhortation to get people to be right with God, whether they've obeyed the gospel or not. So do everything you can to bring out your friends tomorrow evening. Had a wonderful class this morning. Good turnout today. It's just been a wonderful day in your company. You know, I've been asking questions just to kind of stir up your minds, to get you thinking so that we can then kind of have a segue into our study. And the question that I begin our study with this evening is, how many of you like to wait? Do you like when you go to a restaurant and they tell you it's going to be 45 minutes? Are you charged? You like that? Maybe you're calling about a bill. Or maybe the credit card company or the electric company, and they put you on hold, and you're getting messages from a machine, and you've got to push this button and that button, and you're sitting there waiting, and your wait time is approximately 20 minutes. That make you happy? I don't like to wait on anything.
And just ask my kids. I don't like waiting in traffic. I don't like waiting at a light. And I need to work on patience. I know that. But we have developed as a society to be a culture, a group of people that wants everything fast. We want fast internet. We want a fast service in the restaurant. And we want an express lane at the grocery store. And I cheat and go in there when I have more than 15 items sometimes. I just want everything quick. And I expect that most of us are at least to some degree like that. We don't want to waste time. We don't want to spend too much time doing this. And I think that that's part of what affects us sometimes, even in our worship of God and in the preaching of the gospel. I preached, I spent about a month and a half over in Africa a number of years back. And one of the things that stood out more than anything to me there is the fact that time was not a consideration for them. Their culture is entirely different. And as we would preach there, you would preach a sermon. And of course, a sermon took twice as long because it had to be interpreted. You'd finish a sermon and they would say, "Preach another one." Course, through an interpreter, and you'd think, "Are you serious?" And we would preach into the wee hours of the night. And when I was too exhausted and I'd lost my voice and went in to lay down and rest, they stayed up for a few hours singing hymns. What an encouragement. So we've got to be careful about this time thing. We need to understand that we do have time, and we must make time for the most important things. But still, there's no doubt that waiting is a very difficult thing for us. You know, the saying goes that good things come to those who wait. And there's a tremendous amount of truth to that fact. As a matter of fact, the Bible teaches that very thing. In Isaiah chapter 40, in verses 28 through 31, the prophet says, "Have you not known, have you not heard, the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary. The young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." Who is it? Those who wait. Those who have the patience to stop and to wait. We noticed this morning, as we talked about the passage in 1 Corinthians 10 in verses 1 and 2, that he speaks about those who were baptized into Moses under the cloud and in the sea. And we pointed out there in Exodus chapter 14 that as the people were panicking and they see the Egyptian army coming near them, and they're hemmed in, they're stopped by the Red Sea, and they didn't know what they were doing, and it appears that they were tempted to scatter, and Moses says, "Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." His point was, wait on the Lord. The time came when the waters were parted, and God said, "Move forward. Don't stand here. Move forward." There is a time when we wait, and there is a time when we act. We've got to have the maturity to know when that is. But the truth is that we can't always try to take things into our hands. We can't force things. Sometimes we have to wait on the Lord. You say, "How long?" I don't know. It depends on the circumstance. And in my life, I have found that I have absolutely no idea how long I have to wait in certain regards. But it is when I finally resign myself to be content with the Lord's timetable that God brings to pass those things that He has assured me of. Appreciate that song that we just sang, "In His Time." An excellent song, and I kind of threw that at Jeremiah at the last minute. But he did an outstanding job leading us, and it was a beautiful song to sing. And did you think about that song? In His time, not in my time. My time would be everything quick. But that's not always good for me. It's not good for my kids. It's not good for my family. We need to wait on some things. We need to learn we appreciate things. And in many cases, we learn to enjoy things more when we have waited for those things. Wait, I say, on the Lord. Notice with me in the 25th Psalm, the psalmist brings this same consideration out. The 25th Psalm, and in verse 3, I want you to notice where he says, beginning in verse 1, "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. Let me not be ashamed. Let not my enemies triumph over me. Indeed, let no one who waits on you be ashamed. Let those be ashamed who deal treacherously without cause." Skip over to chapter 27. Notice in chapter 27 and verse 14, "Wait on the Lord. Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord." Chapter 37. Just advance there about 10 chapters. And in chapter 37, I want you to notice there in verse 34. "Wait on the Lord and keep his way, and he shall exalt you to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, you shall see it." Then in chapter 40 and in verse 1, "I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined to me and heard my cry." The message is replete throughout the scriptures. We're reminded of it over and over again, and intellectually I know it, but I have to admit to you that even after all these years of being a Christian and a child of God and some 20 years of preaching the gospel, the challenge to wait on the Lord is still sometimes a struggle for me. I want to believe that I'm getting better at it, and I am. It's still a challenge. There's still times when things look fearful, they look bleak, and I can't imagine what's going to happen, and something's got to be done now. And the Lord says, "Stand still, see my salvation. Wait, let me work. Show me that you trust me." It's a difficult thing to do. You know, when God tells us to wait on him, one of the things that often happens is that the longer that we wait, the more that we're tempted to wonder. And maybe to begin to doubt, because we are accustomed to a situation where, in human terms, time begins to determine the reality of something. In other words, if someone has borrowed money from me and they haven't paid me back in 10 years, there's a pretty good chance they're not going to. Time becomes a limitation to us as humans, but it's not a limitation to God. And that's why in 2 Peter 3 and in verse 9 he says, "The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us." And it is in a context where he's talking about the skeptics and the scoffers saying, "Where is the Lord's return? Since the beginning all things continue, and nothing's happened. And he said he's going to come back, and he's still not back." And so he's telling us in this context, don't let time fool you. Just because the Lord has delayed doesn't mean he cannot bring to pass his promise. A day to the Lord is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is a day. That verse is not saying that God doesn't know the difference. That verse is not saying that when God says a day in the days of creation, that he means 1,000 years or 1,000,000,000 years. What that's saying is that time is not a limitation to God. It is not any more difficult for God to do something after 1,000 years than it is after a day. For me it is, but not for God. If God says he'll do it, he will do it. And therefore, he is not slack concerning his promise, as some men are. They say they're going to do something, but then the longer it goes, you know this is true. I've struggled with procrastination all my life. That has been my Achilles heel. I don't know if I got it from my mom or my dad. You know, we always want to blame it on somebody. But what I know is that if I get caught in that trap, the longer I procrastinate, the harder it is to implement. The harder it is to get that done. And sometimes it's been so long, you ever experience this, that I'm embarrassed to go back and take care of that. I'm embarrassed to go to them and say, "Hey, I was supposed to call you back or write you back, and it's been 3 months." You know, sometimes that time is that limitation, but with God, it's not. He's not slack concerning his promise. When he says it, he's going to do it. But you know what? He is long suffering. Sometimes that time that we wait is because God is suffering long maybe with someone else. Maybe he is working in another area, and it is necessary that I wait in my area for all these things to come together. I cannot fully grasp or understand the providential work of God in my life or in the lives of others. But as it has been illustrated before, if I could be on top of a tall building, downtown Fort Worth or downtown Dallas, and I could see all things, I could understand why there's a traffic jam here because of an event here. And if I understood that there's an injury here and they're tending to the dire medical needs of a person here, then I would be able to be patient back here in the traffic jam. I would say, take all the time you need. But when I'm back there and all I can see is a line of cars, I'm impatient. I wish that I could know sometimes all of the details of what's going on and why I'm waiting. But God knows best. And He must know that I don't need to know all those things. The bottom line is, He does reveal to me that many times my waiting is the result of His long suffering. And I would expect that you would agree with me, thanks be to God, that He is long suffering, because I know how long He waited for me to get my life right with Him. And so if God has to suffer long with someone else or in some other realm, and that long suffering requires that I have to wait for someone else to be saved or something else to come to pass, then so be it. We've got to get our perspective right and to see the big picture. God is not slack concerning His promise, but He is patient. You think about God's promise to Nebuchadnezzar. In Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 4, God told him in verse 25 that He was going to dwell in the fields like a beast. It was a year later. 12 months passed before it ever came to pass. And it appears that there was enough time that passed that Nebuchadnezzar probably began to think, that's not going to happen. And then as he began to boast about his kingdom, God's prophecy came true. Just because God waits a while doesn't mean it's not going to happen. And therefore, the exhortation to wait on the Lord is especially prominent and important for each one of us. Wait, I say, on the Lord. They shall walk and not faint. In what areas, though, are we to wait on the Lord? Well, I would expect that the applications of this passage and of this lesson could be nearly endless. There could be a series of a couple of weeks to study in different applications that we could wait on the Lord. I want to look primarily at one this evening. And this has to do especially, or pertains to especially, matters regarding younger people. There are a good number of young people here, and there have been throughout this week. I want you to pay particular attention. That doesn't mean that those of you who are older need to put it in neutral and just coast through the lesson. I want you to pay particular attention, take notes, and be able to share these same things, and to be able to encourage the young people here along this line. The question is that if I am to wait on the Lord, Isaiah 40 speaks about those who wait on the Lord. Who are they? And in what regard? This evening, I want to think about it in terms of those who wait until marriage. Now, like I said, there are a lot of different applications that we might think of that would make very good lessons. We need to wait for God to vindicate us. And we see that in the life of David with Nabal and with Abigail and many other places, certainly in Romans chapter 12 and elsewhere. We need to wait on the Lord for the right kind of growth in the church. We preach the gospel, we plant, and we water, but God gives the increase. And we need to be content to wait on the Lord for the right kind of growth. We wait on the Lord for our home. This world is not my home, and I don't need to put all of my effort into this world. I need to wait on the Lord for my final home. Lots of applications. But young people, I want you to especially think about the significance and the importance of waiting until marriage. And that's a part of waiting on the Lord. Because a lot of young people won't do that. A lot of your friends, a lot of your classmates, a lot of the people that you work with simply are not willing to wait on the Lord until marriage. You say, in what regard, Brett? Well, first of all, in regard to the intimate relationship of marriage, the sexual relationship of marriage. We can be a bit more frank today. And certainly if we're not willing to be, someone else is going to be with our young people. We need to speak to them and communicate with young people in a way that they're going to understand. And so I want to say in a very straightforward manner, God has made absolutely crystal clear that we must wait on the intimate sexual relationship that belongs only in marriage. Notice with me in Hebrews chapter 13, I want you to pay particular attention here to chapter 13 and in verse 4. He says, "Marriage is honorable among all and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers, God will judge." Young people, I want to emphasize the first part of this. Marriage is honorable. It's honorable because, among other reasons, it is a lifelong covenant between two people that requires utter and complete selflessness to work the way that God intends for it to work. It is a lifelong covenant where two people agree and covenant to put the other person ahead of themselves and to love and to express that special love exclusively to one person for the rest of their life. Many of the young people that you know and run around with, go to school with, they're not willing to make a commitment like that. As a matter of fact, they have developed a culture of just being willing to, as they say, hook up whenever and wherever it's convenient. No commitment, no guilt, no relationship, just hooking up. But that commitment, through thick and thin, through good times and through bad times, in sickness and in health, as we say, that's why God has reserved that very special blessing of sexual intimacy for marriage, because that is the only place where two people deserve such a blessing because of that commitment. It is honorable. And the marriage bed, because of that lifelong commitment, there it is undefiled. Many of us have probably grown up in an environment that has made us feel like that the intimacy that belongs in marriage, the sexual intimacy of marriage, that it's dirty. That it's something to be embarrassed about. That it's something we should never speak about. And that it's, yes, that's something that you can do when you're married, but it's still wrong and it's still bad. And I want to disabuse your minds of that. It is, God says, it is pure. It is as pure as anything else could be pure in marriage. It's holy, it's right, it is sweet, and it blesses our lives. God understood that. And it needs to be treated that way in marriage. And too many times there are relationships and marriages where, because of that misconception going into the marriage, it is treated in a way that disrespects one another. And it actually breaks down the relationship instead of building it up as it ought to. Young people, please understand that as you go into this relationship, this is a pure thing, it is a righteous thing, it is a good thing, and it needs to be celebrated between two people. And your children need to understand that while it's not something that we're flippant about and we're not inappropriate in the way that we talk about it, that they understand that that relationship between their mother and their father is not dirty and it's not wrong and it's not bad. It is something that is right and something that is holy. We have got to teach the balance on this. We are facing an epidemic in our culture regarding sexual sin that is fueled by the rampant pornography that's available to us today through social media and the internet like it never has been before. When I was a kid, to access pornography, you had to go into probably a convenience store or some store like that, ask a clerk for a magazine back there that was covered in brown paper, and I mean, it was fraught with danger. You were going to get caught. Not today. It is so accessible. The smartphones that we have, that our children are carrying can access it immediately, easily. We have got to prepare and to preach on and to help and to study with Christians and to guard them from this sin. But a part of that is to have the proper perspective of this intimate relationship in marriage. It is righteous. But he says, fornicators and adulterers God will judge. So this relationship outside of marriage, God says, that brings about eternal hell fire. In marriage, it is one of the most wonderful blessings that God could ever bless us with when handled properly, in the right way. But outside, God will judge. And so this is the reason that I want you to think about waiting until marriage in regard to this. We are warned about sexual sin more frequently than any other form of sin that I'm aware of in the Scriptures. Over and over and over again, because God wants us to understand the consequences, not only the eternal consequences, even the temporal consequences he warns us about, and how it impacts a person when they allow themselves to go down that road. Satan works especially hard. As a matter of fact, I want you to notice how God warns us throughout the Scriptures and the Old Testament Scriptures. I'm impressed by how well God taught His people about the dangers of sexual sin and about the beauty of intimacy in marriage under the old law. Sometimes we think about the old covenant as being harsh and God just gave laws and there was no grace and God didn't really explain things to His people and He was a hard God that killed people and struck them dead. I tell you, there are a number of passages in the Old Testament that are absolutely, I mean, there are countless passages that are tender and sweet and beautiful. The Song of Solomon is a part of the Old Testament. A beautiful, beautiful revelation about this aspect of marriage and of love. And yet, many places we avoid teaching on it because it's awkward and we just don't know how to approach it. And we need to be studying things like this. There needs to be that balance. Notice with me, as a matter of fact, in the Song of Solomon, I want you to notice in chapter 2, where we see this, in chapter 2, I want to begin in verse 4. And we see, I believe, this concept of waiting till marriage brought out. Song of Solomon chapter 2, beginning in verse 4, here is the Shulamite girl, and she's speaking about the young man that she is absolutely smitten by. Not yet married, but they're in love. And the way that they speak to one another is, it's different than the way that we would speak to someone we're in love with, but still, it helps us to understand that this is right. There is a righteous and a holy and a proper way to express those feelings to someone that you love. And it is right to look forward to that union and to that relationship in marriage. But there is also an appropriate way to handle ourselves until we are married. Notice it here. Verse 4. Listen to her. Sounds just like a girl. He brought me to the banqueting house. His banner over me was love. Sustain me with cakes of raisins. Refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. Now, in my house, my boys would say, that's drama. That's dramatic. That sounds like a girl. Well, this is an expression of her feelings. She's overwhelmed. She's caught up in the moment. And notice that his banner over me is love. And this is certainly a message to us men, that one of the things that is so rewarding to the woman that we love, the young lady that we love, is that we are not afraid to express and to show to the world our value for that young woman. This banner over her could be in a number of forms. When we open the door for her, when we speak to her in a kind and a loving and a respectful way in public, rather than making fun of her or making her the brunt of a joke, we lift her up and exalt her. We praise her in the gates, Proverbs 31. Then the banner over her is our love, and she is secure. But notice in verse 6. Now, she's already said she's lovesick. Look at verse 6. His left hand is under my head. His right hand embraces me. Now, things have turned up a degree or two. First of all, she's with him and she's lovesick. Now there is the physical touch. There is an embrace. And she says, his right hand embraces me. And then verse 7, it's almost as if she says, stop. Stop right here. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Now, I freely admit that the Song of Solomon, because it is in this poetic language, there is, I expect that there are a number of parts of this that I may not completely interpret in the right way. I do know the big picture. I do understand the message of the Song of Solomon. But some of the details I may get wrong. But I am fairly confident that what she is saying here is what we've been talking about. That it is right for us to enjoy that time of life of youth when we're falling in love and to express that. But it went to a different level here. It went to a different realm. And most of us understand that. And when that happens, and she had the presence of mind to say, stop. There is an aspect of love that we are not to stir up or awaken until we're married. There are some parts of this relationship. We get to know each other. We're excited. We just can't wait to see each other. We want to talk all night long on the phone. All of those things. That's great. If you can get up and go to work or to school, then that's fine. But there is a physical aspect of this that stirs up and awakens feelings in us that are very difficult to stop. It is a chain reaction. And especially in the young men here, it's like a freight train. And once it's stirred up, and young ladies, I'm not sure that you can even fully comprehend what that is like in a young man. God has certainly made us different. And I'm not saying that young ladies don't have these feelings. They do. But it is magnified in young men. That is one of the areas where we are somewhat different. Do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Why? Because of the seriousness and the danger. Because fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. There's some things that you need to wait on. And this is one of those areas. Don't stir up those kinds of things. And notice, as in Proverbs chapter 7, this entire chapter is speaking about a young man who was devoid of understanding. There were some things he didn't understand, some dangers that were there that he did not comprehend. And it says that he was out at midnight with his friends and with other people. And there is a crafty woman who is waiting for him. And she calls out to him. She kisses him. She flatters him with her words. She speaks about love in a deceptive way. Let us fill ourselves with love until morning, which is certainly a misrepresentation of what they were going to do. And it says there in verse 21, with her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter or as a fool to the correction of the stocks. Till an arrow struck his liver. That is a death blow. That is a mortal wound. That's what he's representing here. Till an arrow struck his liver. As a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. Oh, that's kind of a downer. That's kind of sober. That's kind of serious. Why is God getting so serious here? Because it is serious. Because he wants you to know, when we're young, we want to be happy. We want to have fun. Ecclesiastes 11, the last part of the chapter says, enjoy your youth. With this caveat, know that for all these things, you will be brought into judgment. You're going to be judged on your decisions. Have fun. Enjoy it. But enjoy it in a righteous way. Because there are some decisions and there are some youthful lusts that have lifelong consequences. And that can destroy your life. It can destroy your life here and now. And it can destroy eternal life. He says, now therefore, verse 24, listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths. She has cast down many wounded. Now listen to this one. And all who were slain by her. You read that? Young people, did you read that? All who were slain by her were what? They were weak Christians, right? They were strong men. And the devil is going to deceive you and to make you think, I'm fine. I can go here. I can do this. I can get close to this line without crossing it. I'm strong. I know right and wrong. I'm never going to do that. And God is saying, do not be deceived. Don't let yourself get that close. Do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases, until the right time. And that time is in marriage. In Proverbs chapter 5, I want you to notice, beginning in verse 1, my son, pay attention to my wisdom. Lend your ear to my understanding, that you may preserve discretion and your lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of an immoral woman drip honey. Her mouth is smoother than oil, but in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of hell. Lest you ponder her path of life, her ways are unstable. You do not know them. In verse 8 he says, remove your way far from her. Do not go near the door of her house. See? It's not get close but don't cross that line. You remember when God gave Adam and Eve the instruction regarding the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? He said, do not eat of the fruit of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil, right? Well, actually what he said was, don't even touch it. Do you know that? Don't even touch it. We focus on the fact that she took of the fruit and they ate. God said, don't even touch it. And here he says, don't even go near the door of her house, lest you give your honor to others and your years, you waste and destroy your life, your years to the cruel one, lest aliens be filled with your wealth and your labors go to the house of a foreigner. Now listen to verse 11. And you mourn at last when your flesh and your body are consumed and say, how I have hated instruction and my heart despised correction. Don't make that mistake. He's warning us about it. Then in chapter 6 he says in verse 23, the commandment is a lamp and the law a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life. To keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. Don't lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. Don't get caught in those situations where that's being stirred up and awakened. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread. What a powerful metaphor he's using here. An adulteress will prey upon his precious life. Now listen to these two rhetorical questions. Verse 27 and 28. Can a man take fire to his bosom and his clothes not be burned? It's a rhetorical question. The answer is no. Verse 28. Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? No. So what's the point? The point is, you cannot commit these sins and there not be a significant consequence. I'm not trying to depress those who have committed these sins and may still be suffering the consequences. I'm not trying to bring you down. As a matter of fact, if anything, you need to speak up. And you need to let people know these things will live with you. And when you make these decisions, they will haunt you. And they will impact you. I'm not saying you can't be forgiven. I'm just saying that there are some sins, the temporal consequence of which live with us. And until we get that, we are doomed to commit these sins. You say, well, Brett, it's okay. I'm not going to go anywhere near a harlot, but we're going to get married and we love each other and we're certain we're already engaged, as a matter of fact. And let me assure you, I don't care if you do marry that person. If you compromise in this way, it will skew and impact the way that you look at one another in your marriage. There will be a lack of respect that you will both have for yourself and even for one another that will take years to get past. It will impact the purity and the beauty and the sweetness of that intimate relationship in marriage, because it will bring to memory and to mind what occurred before. Young people, do not believe that lie, that it's okay because we're getting married. There are always, always consequences. Notice also in chapter 9 and in verse 17, he says, stolen water is sweet, And bread eaten in secret is pleasant, but he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of hell. The entertainment that we are confronted with today, the popular movies, what a lot of Christians think is fit to see, PG-13 movies that are fraught and filled with sexual innuendo and simply straight up sexual filth and cussing and violence. One of the messages that they send over and over again is that stolen water is sweet, that bread eaten in secret is pleasant, that there's an excitement and that there's a fulfillment and that there's a happiness that comes when you have to sneak around to do this. And there is. Sin has a passing pleasure. There is a momentary elation that goes with sins like that. The person who shoplifts, they get caught in the high of that. But here's the thing about it. It always crashes. And then a person has to do that again and again and again. It doesn't bring lasting gratification. But this intimacy, when we wait till marriage, when we wait on the Lord till marriage, and we experience and enjoy that in the proper relationship, it is completely, wholly gratifying and blesses our lives so much. When you are in a dating relationship, the advice that I have always given to young people is this: don't ever be alone with a person that you're not married to of the opposite sex. Especially when you are interested or falling in love with that person. That means don't go back to your apartment with that person without someone else there. Don't go back to your parents' house without someone else there. And parents, wake up and don't set your children up to fall. Provide the accountability for them. Have policies in your home that are open door policies. Make sure that you randomly walk into the room or through the room regularly, unannounced, so that they never know when you're going to come through. I mean, these are the things that help us, all of us, to stay pure, because it is a guard, it is a sentry that is put there. But young people, the reason that I'm saying this is because if you always stay in the public eye, you're not going to fail in this regard. It will keep you safe. Why not? Why not do that to save your soul? And I want to mention another thing to you. One of the things that I found in my life that was such a struggle in this area was what I believe was a certain level of inconsistency. And what I want to speak to you about is not something that I would necessarily bind here as a matter of the faith, but it is simply going along this lines of what I just said about not being alone. These are simply principles and words of wisdom that I want to share with you. And here's something I want you to think about. When I was growing up, first of all, I didn't hear a lot of specific, clear teaching about the sin of fornication and how to beware of it, how to overcome it, and how young men are to work through this. It just, you heard a sermon on fornication, it's sin, don't do it, and that's enough. And it wasn't enough. There was an epidemic in the church that I grew up in among the young people. I knew what was going on there, and it wasn't being addressed. And one of the things that I found to be so prevalent in so many cases is that young people had the idea that when you dated, that you could have at least some type of physical contact and intimacy as long as you didn't go all the way. That's when it was a sin. And there was, I think that we knew that there was sin that occurred before that, but it was kind of gray as far as when that happened, and nobody really wanted to talk about it. And here's something that I want to say about that. As we began Song of Solomon 2 and verse 6, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Do not even start those engines. And what that means is that any physical contact needs to be, as per the instructions in 1 Timothy in chapter 5. Look over here with me in 1 Timothy 5. He says in verse 1, to treat an older man as a father, younger men as brothers. Verse 2, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters with all purity. That advice right there, and it was probably read when I was younger, but I don't remember it being applied. Think about what that means. Guys and girls who are dating, think about what that means. For you guys, when you're with this young woman that you're interested in, as far as intimacy is concerned, treat her like your sister. And I know your first thought is, ew, that's gross. You know, maybe at this age you wouldn't want to go to a movie with your sister. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying that as far as the way that you treat her physically would be like your sister. You say, well, I wouldn't even want to sit close to her. Nobody says she's got to sit right there. You know, when I was growing up, the girl always sat right in the middle, you know, right next to the guy. Honestly, the holy kiss. There is a way that I kiss my sister that is absolutely pure, I can assure you. It would gross me out for it to be anything other than that. But I dearly love her. I can spend time with her. I can visit with her. I can talk to her. But there is nothing inappropriate ever. That's the way that you need to handle one another. Now, that this brings us to another thought. What about how far can we go? Making out, as we say, kissing one another. As I said, I grew up with the idea that, well, that's fine. Well, everybody does that. Brett, that's crazy if you're going to say that a couple can't kiss. I'm not saying that you can't. I'm going to say that. You can kiss just like you would kiss your sister. That's what 1 Timothy 5 said. And as a matter of fact, look with me in Colossians, because I think that this makes the point very clear. In Colossians, in chapter 3 here, in the book of Colossians, he makes this point down here in... Romans. I slipped a track there. Romans chapter 13. I want you to read with me there, leading up to verse 14. Romans chapter 13. I want to look there, beginning in verse 11. He says, "And do this, knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore let us cast off the works of darkness, let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy." Now listen to verse 14. "But put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts." Now, when we're talking about in a dating relationship and how far can a young man and a young woman go, and what about kissing? Typically, what we're talking about is the kind of kissing that a boyfriend and a girlfriend would do. And it's the passionate kiss. For lack of a better term, that's what I'm going to call it. It's not the way you kiss your mom or your sister. It's the passionate kiss. I want to ask you a question. Does that kiss make provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust? I think you know good and well that it does. Oh, it does. You say, "Brett, that's innocent. That's innocent." Now, a kiss the way you'd kiss your sister is. I'm talking about the way that a lot of couples kiss before they're married. The passionate kiss. You say, "Well, there's nothing wrong with that." Really? Well, then, would you let another man kiss your wife like that? Why not, if it's innocent? Would you let another woman kiss your husband like that? Moms, you want to defend your kids about this? You need to be real. It's not innocent. It does awaken and stir up. It's something that's going to get that motor running. And that is the segue into the next level, and the next level, and the next level. Why even start there? The Bible says, make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. It says to treat the younger women as sisters. It says, do not stir up or awaken. Can we not get that? You say, "Well, Brett, that's extreme." No, it's not. Any more than what we believe about salvation or marriage, divorce, and remarriage or any other item of the faith. Yes, it's different than the world, but how serious and how important is your purity? Fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. I want you to notice next, not only wait for the Lord for the intimate relationship, but our final point is, and closely related, I need to wait on the Lord for a true helpmeet. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18, the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." That's what we're looking for. That's the whole purpose of dating. It's not, dating is not a sport. Dating is not something you do to pass the time. Dating is a very dangerous realm, honestly, that you enter into. It needs to be handled very carefully. It needs to have a purpose and a goal. And I'm not trying to sterilize it and make it no fun. It certainly can be. But what I'm saying is, if you understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, it will keep you safe. I'm trying to get to know this person to find out if they will actually help me get to heaven. And with a lot of people, that would end the dating scene right there. I don't care how cute she is. I don't care how strong he is. You would know, now that person's not going to be helping me. And it would be over. That's the whole point. A helper comparable. How much is this person going to help you? Or how much grief are they going to give you? In Proverbs chapter 31, in verses 10 through 12, the wise man said, "Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life." Young men, take this seriously. The girl that you're dating, get to know her character. See how she deals with other people. See how she treats her friends. Can she be trusted? Or is this going to be a young woman that when you get married, you never know if she's going to run the credit card up or not? You never know if she's going to spend money behind your back and hide things. You never know if you're going to have creditors calling you. You never know. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. Can you feel confident that when she goes to the grocery store or shopping or on a trip somewhere, that she will never return that eye contact with another man? That she will never send that signal just so that she can get the gratification of knowing that men are looking at her, that she is not going to open that door ever? Sadly, there are a lot of men that cannot live with that confidence because they're married to a young woman who does not do them good all the days of their life. There are a number of different ways that she can betray you. You need to know her character and how she treats other people. Proverbs 11 verse 22 says, "As a ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a lovely woman who lacks discretion. Don't be the fool that looks only at looks." The character is the key. And I want to tell you, I don't care how pretty that young woman is. If she is lazy, if she doesn't take care about her children, if she's focused on her looks and on herself and she is selfish, I don't care how beautiful she is, she will become detestable to you. And if you marry this young woman, you will be bound to her for the rest of your life. A ring of gold in a swine's snout. Looks are not the key. Proverbs 12 and verse 24, "An excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who causes shame is like rottenness in his bones." Warnings over and over again that we need to get to know this young lady. How does she treat her father? Does she respect him? If she makes fun of him and she doesn't speak to him in a respectful way, don't expect her to be submissive and respectful to you. You can expect a lifelong conflict where you know that that is not respectful and right, but she's not going to change. What about the young man? Young ladies, Proverbs 22 and verse 24, "Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go." I don't care how exciting it is when your boyfriend in school will get in a fight at the drop of a hat when another boy looks at you and you think, "Oh, I feel so safe and so secure." That young man's got a temper problem. And he's going to have it when you get married. And he's not going to necessarily be fighting the boys at school anymore. That temper will be turned on you. And when you have children, you'll see him turn that temper on your children, and your heart will literally break, and there's nothing that you can do about it. And it will not be attractive, and it will not make you feel secure and safe. look to the character of this young man. Proverbs 24 and verses 30 through 34, he says, I went by the field of the lazy man and by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding. And there it was, all overgrown with thorns. Its surface was covered with nettles. Its stone wall was broken down. When I saw it, I considered it well. I looked on it and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. So shall your poverty come like a prowler and your need like an armed man. You want to be absolutely miserable? Be married to a guy that can't keep a job or that won't keep a job. He'll have an excuse every time. His boss, the people he's working with, he deserves more than that. He's worth more than that. They won't give him a raise. He had to quit here. He's going to quit there. And over and over again, you're looking at the budget and wondering if you're going to have enough food for the kids. You're wondering how you're going to buy shoes for them. You're wondering how you're going to squeeze out enough money to be able to buy their lunches. You talk about a miserable life, and it's all because you didn't look at those things before you got married. Look at his work ethic. Does this boy have a job? Does he hate work? I'm not saying he's got to love work, but I'm telling you, he needs to understand the place of work and not be afraid of hard work. And he needs to have the attitude and the mindset that he's going to sacrifice of himself to help someone else. He's not always looking how to get out of work. You notice, when there's a job to be done, does he always run and take the clean job and the easy job and leave the hard job for someone else? Then get ready. Because he's not going to be helping you much, girls. Proverbs 26 and verse 13 through 16. The lazy man says, there's a lion in the road. A fierce lion is in the street. See his excuses? There'll always be a reason why he can't go to work. As a door turns on its hinges, so does the lazy man on his bed. The lazy man buries his hand in the bowl, and it wearies him to bring it back to his mouth. But the lazy man is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. You won't be able to convince him. He's always got a reason, and he believes it. And you're going to have to live with it. You want to be miserable? Be married to this man. The point here is, you need to find someone who is going to help you get to heaven. And sometimes that means that we have to wait. One of the things that I can remember so vividly from working with all of the young people there in Lubbock, Texas, is how often I would see these college students. They first got there, they had a lot of friends, and they were having fun, and everything was good. And somewhere after about a year or two, maybe three, but certainly by that second year for the most part, all of a sudden they recognize this void in their life. And friends aren't enough. They need someone to fill that void, and they're looking for that person. And the longer that time goes on, the more forlorn they get, and they're worried, am I going to find that person? And why haven't I found the right person? What's wrong with me? And why haven't I been able to connect with this person? And I can't tell you how many times I've sat in my office with one of these college students, and my heart breaking for them. I know how sad, how lonely they feel, and I can't fix it for them. But what I can tell them is, wait on the Lord. He always comes through for us. It may be that you still need some work to be prepared for the girl that you think that you deserve, or for the boy that you think that you deserve. And it may be that perfect person that you're waiting on, the Lord still has a little bit more work to do on them. Maybe it's just a few weeks. Maybe it's a few months. You know, if you could know that, it would be like, oh, that's great. Okay, I can wait. You know, it's like, hey, you're going to get a new car, but they're not going to be finished with it. It doesn't come out of the factory until next month. Hey, I'm good. I can wait. If we knew that, but we can't. But here's what we can know. God makes all things beautiful in His time. You believe it? Wait on the Lord. We think about Jacob with Rachel. In Genesis 29 and verse 20, it says, so Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love that he had for her. What I can tell you is that when you get there, and when you find that person, and when you begin this relationship, when you look back on it, it won't seem nearly as long as what it did when you were looking forward. Wait on the Lord. You know, when we think about waiting on the Lord, as I said earlier, the Lord waited a long time for me to get my life really right with Him. I should be willing to wait on Him. But this evening, if you need to obey the gospel, don't wait to obey the gospel. Acts 22 and verse 16 says, "Why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord." Wait on the Lord. Wait for those things that are right and that are good. But don't wait to obey the gospel. You need to do it right now. You need to do it tonight. Why not? Why not tonight? Won't you please come while we stand and sing the invitation song?